managerial thought.
Yeah, I would probably like to add as a postscript a couple of salient facts. When we headed south, first of all, the normal routine for a ship's flight is to work a day routine or an as required routine. Every time the aircraft is needed to fly, we're there to fly it. Every time it's broken, we have to fix it. Obviously, there's a in time of great strife, stress, and other commitment to the ship, there's no way anybody can work for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's not physically possible. So the best compromise, you go into a war situation, a two-watch system, you split your flight into half, and we were working a four-hour shift system. So we worked 4 hours on and 4 hours off. That's over 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So every 4 hours you were getting up, going to work, every 4 hours you were going back to sleep, or trying to. With the exception, of course, as soon as you go to action station, then everybody's at their action station. And again, because of our trade demarcation, if you had a defect or a problem with the aeroplane within your trade, and you happened to be off watch, then you were called out to repair the aircraft, because that was our prime function. So the hours we worked actually were phenomenal hours in that period. But then again, the entire ship's company did. But the good thing about all that was that there was never any complaint about that from any of the people. They knew that was their job and that's what we were there to do. And I thought they all responded absolutely magnificently to the challenge of that. You have to couple with that, you have to try to be, in among all this, you've got to be fed and watered. And as we kind of started, probably ill-prepared on the Antrim for a prolonged period at sea, with regard to stores and storing the ship, our food supplies weren't probably as good as they could have been. And again, because we were one of the spearhead ships, we left early before ships were fully stocked. And consequently, after sort of a couple of months, our food stocks were getting fairly low. And we were actually on a form of food rationing. So instead of like meal choices, the meal was take it or leave it. And at times we did have some strange meals produced for us. I remember one day eating fillet steak and tinned carrots, because that's all there was. Vegetables, fresh vegetables and stuff like that, we just didn't have them for a long, long time. Towards the end we did, because then that type of stores started to catch up. But obviously going to the war at the height of a conflict period, then war stores are priority. And although your men are vital, as long as there is food for them which sustains them, the delicacy and the silver service isn't required. So we did eat some strange food, or strange concoctions, if you like. And a lot of our eating had to be done on the run, and then at times the meal times just didn't occur because obviously we were action, or there was events going on which superseded that. So it was a very trying time.
What were these things that you fell out with the flight commander about early on?
Oh, it was only a stressful position. It's ironic in a way that I'd only just joined the ship and he didn't really know me. And this was like the first incident where I had to ground the aircraft. What had happened, we had a slight accident in the hangar and we knocked a hole in the aeroplane. It was on primary structure. And the repair manual says this must be repaired. We were programmed to be flying at that time. I think we were moving troops or something like that. And I just called the bridge and I said, I'm sorry, there's damage on this aircraft and it can't go, I must repair it. Flight commander came into the hangar sort of in a high state of excitement about what had happened and all the rest of it. So I explained that to him and I said, I've got to repair it. And then he said, no, we won't, we'll fly and then you can repair it afterwards. And I dug my heels in. I thought, no, we can't do this. This isn't correct. He said, what will the effect if I do fly? I said, I really don't know, because it's got a large split in the aircraft, which I should repair. But if it suddenly unzips, I mean, the aircraft could fall in half in the worst possible situation. Unlikely, but a maybe. And we had a little bit of a heated discussion about it, which he then ordered me to get the aircraft on deck and get it to fly. So I allowed things to cool for 10 minutes and decided this really still wasn't the right way of doing things. So I then went to see him. I got my repair manuals and details out and went off to see him. Went up to the wardroom, went down to his cabin with him and had a discussion. At that time he had obviously also cooled down as I had. And then we had a sane discussion. And he asked me what the consequences. I said I couldn't fully tell him, but I strongly advise he didn't. And then he said to me, how long will it take you to repair it? And I said, 6 hours. He said, you have 6 hours. In 6 hours' time, he said, we will be flying. I said, fine, it will be done. And luckily, we managed to achieve the repair, myself and Lionel Kerr and the POTIF with me. A little bit ad hoc, because we didn't have 100% correct materials and we didn't have all the rivets I would like to have had and things like that, but we achieved a, well, totally satisfactory repair. And we did it in 6 hours, so when he came marching down, our airplane was wheeled out and ready for him. And, you know, I told you. And it was there, fortunately. And I suppose that then restored his confidence in us. At the end of the day, he's the man flying that airplane, therefore he's got to be confident in the men repairing it. And later on, it's a bit ironic, really, because I worried about, you know, at this stage, one split in this aeroplane, and later on, we were flying with about 120 holes in the aeroplane. Totally different conditions. We were now under war conditions, which the rules do change dramatically at that situation. But there was, I mentioned we pulled some other, not stunts, major decisions had to be made. We had one or two bits of electronic equipment which weren't working very well. And when I lost Terry, he was my greenie, my electrician. And at that point, unfortunately, he was working on a defect in the aircraft when he was wounded. And there was no one left to fix it. I had a petty officer there who wasn't as competent as Terry. In fact, this man that rose to the occasion and managed to fix it. And a little later on, we had another problem with the aircraft generation system, which was baffling everybody. And it was a couple of the voltage control regulators. And I had three of them, and they were all unserviceable for the same thing. And we didn't really know what it was. And I had a radio mechanic. He's an electronics man, but didn't understand this equipment because it's not his equipment. So we took all three of them into the workshop, opened the boxes up, and had a look in to see what we could find. Now, Jim McKee, my radio man, he understood wiring diagrams far better than I do. And he managed to finally identify a component in the box, which he could then relate to the wiring diagram, and then he generated it from there, and then he traced it, and we finally found, in fact it was the same item in each box which had actually burnt out, which we didn't actually have any, but we went down to the ship's electricians and said, what spares have you got? It was a diode we needed. And they found us a similar diode, not the right one. So they said, what do we do? So put it in. We've got nothing to lose. So we unsoldered it out of the board, soldered a new one in, put it in the aircraft, and it worked perfectly. So it's like, you know, ad hoc repairs. And that's what we had to do. I mean, one of the bomb carriers got torn off the side of the aircraft, and the mounting brackets were broken. I went down to the mechanical workshops in the ship and found some metal and up in the hangar made some brackets, not the, you know, specified material, but I made brackets and fitted into the aircraft so we could hold the bomb carrier back on, and we used it. I mean, this is where the rules change because you're at war, and I think this is where you get the satisfaction. I mean, I was trained as an artificer to make things and construct things and make things work. Most of the time you are constrained by flight safety, airworthiness and things like that. In peacetime, we must do these things precisely right. When you go to war, the most important flight is the next one. And if the aircraft comes back, then the most important flight is the next one. So if you like, you're preparing an aircraft for one flight only every time. And you assess it between every flight. So therefore, if you like, my trade, which I'd learnt years before, I was now able to exercise to the full. Unfortunately, I rose to the challenge, shall I say, and we managed it. With a lot of help from my my maintainers, I must add, you know, my team. It's not a sole event. There was 12 of us working very hard to achieve, and we did achieve.
Did any decorations come your way?
I was awarded a British Empire Medal subsequent to the Falklands. The flight commander was awarded the DSO, along with the captain of the ship. And the other three members of the air crew were mentioned in dispatches. And that was over the prime route of that was the incident on the Fortuna Glacier and the subsequent events around South Georgia, really. I mean, they were really working very much on the edge and almost over it.